The Tempest sliced through the wind chop with hardly a shudder. Though Ryan couldn't see it, he sensed the expanse of empty black sea and sky ahead. He only had a rough sense of their direction, but he knew Harmonica Tom was putting as much distance between them and the harbor as quickly as he could. The strong crosswind that drove the ship did nothing to cut the humidity, and the air was much warmer than his body temperature. It was like breathing in steam. Riding on the breeze was the raw stench of the raging petroleum fires they'd left behind, a stench straight from the bowels of hell. Ryan looked off the stern and saw only darkness behind them. Sky and land made indivisible. He remembered what Veracruz had looked like the night before. The brilliant glow of its electrics, so full of promise, of hope for the resurrection of human civilization. It turned out that the hope was tainted by the usual suspects, the murderous and the avaricious. Not that that mattered in the long view. It was all gone now. A nest of busy ants crushed under a boot heel. The outcome gave him no satisfaction. Just the opposite. Too many innocent people had been harmed, and would be harmed for years, perhaps decades to come. Was there an upside? Could the people of Veracruz seize the opportunity and throw off their oppressors? Or would they buckle under once more? Before the end was in sight, he had no doubt that more innocents would suffer and die. The revenge for what had been done to Garwood Reed and his fellow Padre Islanders had just begun. Ryan was free of chains for the first time in nearly a month. But instead of elation and relief, he felt anxious, keyed up. He wanted to run until his lungs and legs gave out, but he couldn't even pace the ship's deck. It was so dark on the water he couldn't see his hand in front of his face. The only light was the faint reddish glow of the helm's control panel and compass. Although Ryan was free of physical restraints, he hadn't escaped yet. Not really. He would never be free while his companions were missing and in chains. He couldn't go back to Deathlands without them, without finding out what had happened to them. Black sea, black sky, black ship, and the entire world to get lost in. The monumental scale of the task made him feel something he didn't expect, something he didn't like one bit, something he wasn't used to. It made him feel inadequate. After they had run with the wind for the better part of an hour, Tom switched on the deck and cabin lights. The yellow glow barely penetrated the surrounding gloom, but at least they could see the limits of the ship. Chucho glanced up at him.
No one's coming after us?
Even if they are, by now we're way past their line of sight, over the curvature of the earth. No way are they going to see the deck lights. I'll leave the mast lights off. No need to tempt fate.
Couldn't a ship come up on us from behind? Overtake us?
There wasn't a ship in that harbor that could catch us. Not while we're being pushed by wind like this. Not even the Mattachine tugs. And that's assuming they guessed right on which direction we took.
Tom looked down at his feet. A fan of blood and guts lay spread across the cockpit's deck, narrow at the companionway end, much wider at the stern rail. They were standing in the splatter the PKM had blown out of the red sash boarding party. Their boot soles had smeared pink streaks on the no-slip textured fiberglass.
But you two cleaning up the mess, or we'll be tracking it below decks.
I don't mind.
Chucho shrugged and nodded. The Hero twins set to work in the cockpit, and along the combing and port rail. With hand brushes, they scrubbed down the fiberglass and the stainless steel fittings, and then sluiced everything out of the scuppers with the washdown hose. When they were done, they rinsed off the soles of their boots as well. After they had finished, Tom wrinkled up his nose.
You two could really use a wash, too. Use the shower in the main cabin. There's extra clothes in the drawers under the bed, and while you're at it, open the front companionway door, get some airflow going, blow the cordite stake out.
We haven't eaten in a while, either. I'm so hungry my gut's in a knot.
There's a pot of beans on the side of the stove. Some tortillas, too. Cooked bacon, hard-boiled eggs, fruit on the table. Help yourselves.
Ryan followed Chucho down the stairs. There was spent brass everywhere.
Go on. You get washed first. I'll pick up the shells so we don't trip and break our necks.
Oh, don't worry. I won't use all the hot water.
After gathering up 100 or so empty casings, Ryan helped himself to food. A bowl of cold beans with crumpled bacon and chopped eggs sprinkled on top. He used the corn tortillas to scoop it up and shovel it in. As he finished up, Tuto returned to the galley in shorts and a t-shirt, his long hair dripping wet. He immediately dished himself some grub. He was still eating when Tom joined them below decks. Once the skipper had the sails trimmed out the way he wanted them, he had lashed ropes to the wheel, his version of an autopilot. Ryan had seen him do this many times before.
I set a rough course to east-southeast. Gonna let this wind put more distance between us and the Mattachine.
How are we gonna find the others? Where do we even start looking?
Harmonica Tom grimaced and shook his head, stroking the ends of his long, sandy mustache.
You said something about a black ship? Sailboat?
Yes, a three-masted schooner.
I know that boat. It is the property of the Lords of Death. A special-purpose ship. If your friends are on it, I know where they are being taken. Tom, do you have a chart of the land and sea to the south?
Tom pulled a map from his bookcase. He unrolled it and spread it out on the galley table.
We are here, and the water's off Veracruz.
Ryan's double planted a brown fingertip on the paper. Not on the Atlantic side, but the Pacific, and a dot on an island near the coast. And a long way from where they were.
Xibalba. They are being taken to Xibalba. The island was called Coiba before Armageddon, or Devil's Island. It was a government prison for the most dangerous criminals.
That's Panama. Or, at least it was.
He did a quick hand span calculation of the distance and frowned.
It's at least 1,500 miles from here. Wait, look here. This here is a ship canal dug from east to west across the isthmus way before Armageddon, connecting the two oceans. Chucho, you telling me the canal is still there? It wasn't hit by a nuke strike?
It's not there. But it wasn't hit by a missile. Nuke, they brought terrible earthquakes to Panama, to all of Central America. The quakes broke the canal's locks. When that happened, water came pouring out of the artificial lakes. Water from the lakes is what filled the canals and floated the ships. More water dammed up than you can even imagine. When the locks broke, there was an incredible flood in both directions, east and west, from the high point of the canal. It washed out most of the city at the Atlantic end, and badly damaged the city at the Pacific end. Now, the only time there is water in the canal is when it rains, and the only way to cross Panama is to go overland.
Ryan tapped at Coiba Island on the map and frowned.
Why are they being taken to this place? Come on. What is it?
I won't lie to you. It is very bad, my friend. I don't understand the white coat science behind it. I don't know anybody who does. I know the outcome because I have seen it myself. The Lords of Death take ordinary people to Xibalba and turn them into monsters by poisoning their blood. They do this to create more Inanos, their plague carriers. After the transformation, they send these soulless devils out into the world to do their bidding, to spread disease, destruction, and fear. The Inanos want to live so badly, they will do anything the Lords tell them, even unthinkable things. They can't help it. There is no way to tell the devils from regular people. They don't look sick, they don't act sick. That makes everyone a suspect until the dying is done and only the Inanos are left standing. The Lords of Death have fielded an army that is more powerful and deadly than the Mattachine. An army that can't be seen and can't be stopped. They'll make your friends soldiers in that army if they live through the poisoning of their blood.
White coat shit.
How long does it take to turn somebody into one of these things?
A few weeks. But it is very painful. And as I said, many more die than live through it.
How do you know all this?
I've captured some of these Inanos. And I've tortured them, holding out the promise of merciful death until they told me all they knew. And I have traveled.
You've been there? To this Xibalba?
After I escaped prison the second time, or maybe it was the third, I needed to cool off, to make myself scarce for a while. I came to Panama with a comrade in arms, a fellow former prisoner who hated the red sashes and priests as much as I did. We crossed the 50 miles of jungle to the Pacific side of the canal, and we wanted to see if the Lords of Death were really gods, and if they weren't, to kill them in their beds. We stole a rowboat from the mainland.
What happened?
Never got close enough. The Lords live in and around the old prison compound, an island in the middle of an island. We landed on the beach at Coiba, but we never found the gates of Xibalba.
Why not?
There are many bad things there.
You mean Marachin?
No, we didn't see any pirates. The island is covered with jungle, so thick you can't even hack through it. Under that canopy, it is very dark, very hot. A green hell. The only way to advance is to follow the creeks up and down the steep ravines the water has cut in the mountainsides. It is very slow going. The footing is treacherous. A deep, ankle-grabbing litter of palm fronds and leaves. And hiding in the litter, there are snakes. Suspended in the branches and strangler vines overhead, there are vampire bats. In the creeks themselves, hiding under the log jams, are crocodiles. But worst of all are the dogs.
Dogs?
They're the offspring of the animals who were on the island back when it was a prison. They've been running loose in the jungle in wild packs, breeding, killing, eating anything they can catch for over 100 years. They're not afraid of anything or anyone. And you can't outrun them either.
You made it out?
Barely. We were deep in the jungle when they picked up our scent. We could hear them baying off in the distance. We couldn't see them, but from the sounds of the howler monkeys, we knew they were circling and closing in on us. We turned back for the boat at once. They were on our heels as we broke through to the beach. Big, powerful dogs. 80, 90 pounders. Huge heads and jaws. Snarling and snapping, crazy for the kill. My friend was pulled down from behind as we ran. He was still screaming when I hit the water. There was no time to try for the boat. I had to swim away for my life. I treaded water off the island for a long time. I was lucky the sharks didn't find me. When I swam back for the boat, there was nothing left of my friend but the bloody rags of his clothes scattered over the sand. The dogs had torn up his body and dragged the parts into the jungle to eat. I rode back to the mainland by myself.
So no one knows what's in this Shabalba?
Or if this Adipo the Tenth or any of the Lords of the Dead are real?
The Enanos know what's there. The ones I questioned thought Adipo the Tenth was real. They claim to have seen him sitting on his golden throne. They described the palace hidden in the wide clearing, deep in the heart of the jungle. Sumptuous, spacious apartments for each of the 12 lords. Many slaves, many minor devils to provide them companionship and amusement. Hanging gardens, broad avenues, and displays of stolen treasure. The Enanos all told me that the approach to the gates of the underworld is lined with many terrible trials, many deadly traps. These are designed to protect the Lords of Death from intruders. We never got close enough to encounter any of them.
What are the Lords of Death so afraid of?
Afraid? No. They're like the Shibalban dogs. They're not afraid of anything. They've perfected their domain and their dominance. They are content with pulling the strings that make the wider world jerk. They want nothing to disturb their pleasure.
How did criminals get to be self-appointed gods?
The story the Enanos told me is this. Nuke, they broke open the prison and freed the island's convicts who were being used for weapon testing by whitecoats from the north. Coiba was and is remote and dangerous, the perfect place to develop secret and illegal weapons of disease. If the diseases accidentally got loose, their spread could be controlled and no one cared if the prisoners lived or died. After all, they were the scum of the earth. When the pre-dark die-off rate was unexpectedly high, the whitecoats had to import non-convicts for the tests. After Armageddon, the prisoners used the island as a base for their piracy. In the early days, Matachin recruited crews from the ruined port towns on the Atlantic side, and they conscripted sailors from captured ships on the high seas. The choice they offered was to join them or die. They tried to move their operations north to the cities of Cancun, Veracruz, and Tampico, where the real booty was, but even with expanded navies, they didn't have enough fighters to do the job. They were driven back time and again. That's when they forced the few surviving whitecoats to start thawing out the disease weapons, bringing the freezies back to life.
And the god business?
That plays on ancient fears and superstitions to keep the populations under control, using minimum manpower and without resorting to more plague. Too much plague would kill too many people, and without workers to rob and enslave, the lords would have nothing. The only way to end their reign of evil is to find them and kill them all.
Tom, how long will it take to get there?
The trader pointed at a dot on the map that read Cologne, a city at the Atlantic end of the canal.
A week, maybe 10 days, depending on the wind. If it dies on us, it'll die for the black sloop, too. We shouldn't lose any ground on them.
They have a full day's start on us now. How are we going to make it up?
Don't know if we can. Depends on how much of a hurry they're in to offload their cargo, how much sail they put up.
Even if we can't catch them at sea, maybe we can get to them before they reach the other coast.
The trail across the isthmus to the far side is 50 miles long. It's hard going through jungle, and there are many, many places for ambush.
And we'd better catch them before they leave Cologne.
J.B. Dix stood near the bow of the black ship as it porpoised through white-capped, milky azure seas. As the ship lurched, he leaned this way and that, swaying on the balls of his feet, eyes half shut. He felt like he was floating a foot or two above the deck's rough planking. Defeat. Tasted like chicken in a spicy red sauce. Lassitude had set in on the second day out of Veracruz, a combination of the stultifying heat of the tropics, which he was not used to, and the realization that Ryan was by then most likely chilled, and that he had been unable to do anything to prevent it. The familiar hand of Dr. Monteo pressed the middle of his back and gave him a hard shove toward the port rail.
Keep moving!
Every day, once a day, the head white coat took the captives up on the top deck for limited exercise and a dose of fresh air. They were brought up individually, in chains, and at blaster point. JB and the white coat were trailed by a very bored Matachine holding a 9mm submachine gun by its pistol grip. JB lurched onward, face into the wind, forced to take baby steps by his manacles. How many days had they been sailing south nonstop? It was hard to keep count. At least a week, perhaps more. The idea that he and the others could overcome their captors had turned out to be a pipe dream, a bitter pill to swallow. As on the slave galley, the Matachine had given them no window of opportunity for revolt. They'd foreseen and plugged every possible crack. JB hadn't laid eyes on Mildred or Christy since they'd left Veracruz. The separated companions had yelled back and forth to one another through their cabin cell doors, but they could hardly make out the words for the intervening walls, the wind and the sails, and the loud, constant hiss of the hull sliding through the sea. As of a few minutes ago, the women were still alive. On the morning of the third day, Doc had deduced that they were being drugged at every meal. It appeared their only choice was not to eat, but if they didn't eat, they'd be too weak to stage a successful escape. It was another cruel irony, something at which the pirates excelled. As JB headed for the stern, he visualized the round brown faces of the female white coats as they brought in the tainted food. So bright, so happy, so bubbly. Not smug or superior or dismissive. They were simply glad to be of use. As twisted as their work was, it was clear they loved it. Once a day, the companions were taken out of their cabin, individually weighed, measured with calipers, and examined. This while Dr. Monteo took careful notes. Then he escorted them on their slow circuits around the top deck, keeping track of the numbers of turns they did and the elapsed time. The head white coat seemed very pleased by the course of events as well. There was always a hint of glee in his dark eyes. Infuriating glee. JB had noted that he never perspired either, no matter how hot the sun got. Since they'd left Veracruz, JB hadn't seen Casacampo, the Matachine commander, either. But there were always dreadlocked sailors on deck when he took his forced constitution. They made nasty comments as he baby-stepped past them and laughed. If he could have gotten hold of one of their gut-hook machetes, he would have given them something to laugh at. He would have split their filthy heads from crown to chin and washed his hands in the jetting blood. 5 baby steps later, the gory fantasy had vanished. JB couldn't hold it in his mind to further flesh it out. Another few shuffling steps, and he had indeed forgotten it. A flurry of questions occurred to him. How many miles had the black sloop covered so far? How far south were they going? Were they headed to the ends of the earth? Was there even such a place? Why would the pirates take them there? In a minute or so, the questions themselves disappeared. JB found it strange and deeply unsettling that he couldn't manage to be sad over Ryan's presumed death. Not a single tear had he shed. It felt as though all his emotions had been ripped out or buried under the paralyzing weight that filled his limbs and muddled his mind. Only one thing kept him from being a complete zombie. He still had his fury, his outrage. deep down, the heat of it, like embers of a fire that had burned out, remained. He clung to its familiar but fading warmth. Doc and Jack had experienced the same inexorable withdrawal from reality. Nothing mattered, as long as the procedures went smoothly, as long as they ate their dinners and submitted to the daily examination. And the longer the voyage stretched on, the less anything mattered. Death would have almost been preferable to this limbo, this half-existence. But JB didn't want to check out with chains around his wrists and ankles. He wanted to die with a blaster in his hand, having fired every round in the mag into his enemy's guts. Although JB and Doc had tried to pump the fire talker in the cabin next door for information, Daniel had never let slip anything of use either. It was hard for JB to believe he didn't know any more than they did about where they were going and why. Over the days and nights of confinement, the Freezy's through-the-wall ramblings had become more and more disjointed. He kept confusing the science fiction series he'd worked on before Skydark with events in the current reality. He had begun to mix up the pre-dark pulp publisher and staff with the Lords of Death. Was he raving because of the opiates in his food? Or because his mind had cracked under the strain like a raw egg? Over and over, Daniel recapped the tedious plots of his novels. Even worse, he dramatized the pivotal scenes of the 250-title story arc using an array of irritatingly unconvincing voices. He never tired of the activity, and he seemed to delight in how crazy it made Jack. There were dents in the sheet steel wall where the albino had pounded with his fists to try to end the monologues. At one point, Jack had tried to articulate to Doc and JB the reasons for his violent loathing.
Stinkhole, never shot, blasted, never chewed, face-to-face, piece-of-shit, liar, never shuts up.
Which just about covered it, as far as JB was concerned. As JB and his white coat escort rounded the black ship's bow, he saw the tiniest dark sliver of coastline on the starboard horizon. It hadn't been there before. One of the sailors pointed in that direction.
Milana! Tierra!
Soon, all the pirates were grinning and pointing. A few moments later, the deck banked sharply as the sloop heeled over, steering for the strip of land. JB turned back to look at the helm and saw that Casacampo was behind the wheel. The commander had decked himself out in full battle gear, his body armor oiled and gleaming, glittering masses of looted trinkets in his rat's nest coif, and wrapped in coils around the ankles of his boots. He had applied a fresh coat of mascara to his eyes. His long beard was braided into a half dozen jutting pigtails, and he held a stub of a cigar clenched between his teeth. Under a hammering sun, a knob end of land gradually slid into view, and upon it sat what appeared to be a large city, its extensive skyline backlit in hard silhouette. The low-lying panorama was dominated by a pair of enormous pre-dark buildings, 15 or 16 stories high. They were bigger than anything he'd seen in Veracruz. Structures half as tall clustered around their flanks. JB had to shield his eyes from the painful glare off the water that was magnified by the lenses of his spectacles. When he glanced over at Dr. Monteo, he saw delight in the white coat's face. The closer they got to the shore, the less appealing the place looked to JB. It wasn't just the backlighting that made the buildings appear so dark. Everything was green. Dark, dark green. Even the twin towers were shrouded with vegetation. The jungle had reclaimed its turf. Mildred, with Christy right behind her, let herself be half-dragged up the companionway by a dreadlocked pirate. If it was unbearably hot below the black sloop's decks, it was even hotter above. As she and her odoriferous escort stepped out into the air, the tropical sun's rays scorched her bare arms and shoulders like a flame. Pretending to be drugged was easy. To convince her captors, all she had to do was half-close her eyes, hang her head, go semi-limp, and shuffle her feet as she was towed along. Behind her, Christy was pulling the same stupefied act. After the first 24 hours aboard ship, after eating three of the wonderful meals, Mildred had figured their food was being tampered with. Christy's stolen fork was confiscated that same night while they were unconscious. After that, they'd been left to eat with their fingers. What they were experiencing wasn't just exhaustion or the effects of long-term starvation. It was opiates. Mildred decided that the white coats had to be sprinkling the drug in the delectable sauces instead of injecting it into the meat. It was the only way to assure the captives got a full dose. To test this hypothesis, she waited until the little brown women left the cabin to bring meals to the others. Then she carefully washed off all the meat in the sink. She and Christy ate it and ditched the rest of the food down the drain. Her guess was right. The chicken, pork, and beef didn't soak up the drug from the sauce. In an hour or so, the feeling of stupor and dizziness completely vanished. Unfortunately, there was no way to communicate this discovery to the men. JB, Doc, and Jack were already lined up on deck when she got there. They didn't look well. And from the dilated state of their pupils, they weren't faking it. She and Christy had tried to warn them about the food, but they couldn't tell if their shouts had been heard. JB looked at her and barely moved his lips.
Grub is poisoned. Ryan's probably dead by now.
Mildred felt a catch in her throat, an agonizing ache that spread down to her breastbone. Under the circumstances, grief was a luxury. She refused to give in to it. That's what Ryan would have done. That's the way he would have wanted it. Doc and Jack were in no better shape than JB. They had known the food was tainted and they'd eaten it anyway. Probably because they figured out they had to have it to regain their strength. Mildred was amazed that they hadn't realized they could just wash it off and be safe. Maybe they discovered the problem too late. Or maybe by then, they were too drugged to reason it out. Maybe the white coats had kept better watch on them, making sure they ate it all. At least she and Christy were drug-free. Mildred scanned the green vista across the water ahead. She had a fair idea of how far they'd come. Because they weren't doped up, she and Christy had been able to keep track of the number of days they traveled and to estimate the average speed. Because the pirates thought she was drugged to the gills, or because they didn't give a damn, they had been less careful about what they'd said in Mildred's presence. She had overheard them mention a name that she knew. A possible, even a likely, destination. Cologne. Panama. In her former life, before she had been cryogenically frozen, Mildred had never visited Cologne City, but she knew a little about it, having closely followed the news coverage of the U.S. invasion and fall of the Panamanian military dictator Manuel Noriega in 1989. She knew Cologne was situated at the Atlantic entrance to the Panama Canal. If the city had been taken back by the jungle, the world-famous canal was nowhere to be seen. As the black sloop neared the entrance to the bay, Casacampo's crew dropped the sails and started up the ship's engines. It appeared the route to landfall was too tricky for wind power. Though broad, the bay had filled in on either side with dense stands of mangrove scrub, leaving a deep but narrow central channel. Cloudy turquoise water lapped against a dark, impenetrable tangle of tree roots. The air had an oppressive, yellowish tinge. A sickly place, Mildred reckoned, cooking at a slow simmer in the 90-plus heat of midday. The atmosphere was sulfurous, thick with the smell of biological decay and swamp muck. Ahead, between the bow of the black ship and the overgrown ruin of a city, the beach was not sand. It was a flat of beige-colored, pestilential mud. The city's buildings, covered with greenery, reminded her of the Mayan temples in Guatemala she had vacationed toward before Skydark. Enormous complexes buried under mounds of earth and vegetation. Every distant hilltop, the tip of yet another lost temple. How many people had lived in Cologne, the gateway to the Pacific, before the end of the world? She guessed a couple of 100,000. Something truly catastrophic had happened here. Something different than the tidal wave damage Veracruz had suffered. In Veracruz, the surviving population had been large enough to keep the jungle beaten back, to maintain a semblance of the pre-dark status quo. Whatever had happened in Cologne, its impact had been much more devastating to infrastructure and to the human population. Mildred had to figure the canal was a likely target for a Soviet MIRV on Hell Day, but this disaster hadn't been the direct result of a nuke strike. If it had, there would have been the remains of a crater, a dead zone filled in with seawater. No buildings would have been left standing. Perhaps the all-out exchange of 2001 was over and done with before the Soviet ICBM aimed at the canal left its launch pad. As she looked for the canal entrance, the first of the series of locks that raised and lowered ship traffic, and saw nothing but mangrove swamp, it dawned on her. The canal was gone. The locks were gone. Maybe the dams that held back the fresh water used to lift the ships over the isthmus were gone, too. Ahead, the narrow ship channel was marked at intervals with tied-together clusters of floating, oil-stained, white plastic jugs fixed to the bottom with nylon rope. Closer to the shore, two sailing ships were moored on the edge of the channel, anchored fore and aft to keep from drifting onto the flats. Their crews were nowhere to be seen. Farther on, in much shallower water, a half-dozen small, open fishing boats were tied to another claptrap buoy. There were no power vessels of any size, which made Mildred wonder if the Matachine kept all their engine-powered ships farther north, closer to the primary sources of fuel. That made sense if fuel supplies were limited and transport was difficult. Beyond the fishing boats, she could see the uneven stumps of immense concrete pier pilings, the pier decks having been ripped away. Framing the nasty bay on three sides were low, heavily jungled hills. Had all this vegetation, had this complex ecosystem really survived a nuclear winter, a global deep freeze that had supposedly lasted 10 years? Mildred had always had serious doubts on that subject. After all, who supposedly had been keeping track of the time and temperature post-nuke day? A short distance from the shoreline, half in, half out of the water, was the twisted base of an enormous latticework steel tower. It jutted like the bloody skeleton of some prehistoric reptile. The other end of the ruined tower was submerged, buried under the pale mud. In between, Mildred could see the rusting framework, some 200 feet of it, just under the murky surface. The waterfront of Cologne had been rebuilt after the disaster, albeit on a much less ambitious scale. The modern city had become a shantyville on stilts over the stinking tidal mudflats, a maze of whitewashed single-story buildings connected to one another and to the solid ground inland by elevated wooden walkways on flimsy-looking peckerpole pilings. Beyond the peaks of the sheet metal roofs, on the other side of a narrow road cut, was a 20-foot-high solid wall of green leaves and branches. Mildred's musings cut short as Casacampo raised an arm and pointed.
Drop anchor!
The pirate crew hopped to it, anchoring the black sloop securely fore and aft, within 100 yards of the nearest shanty on stilts. There were no fortifications in evidence, no gun emplacements either. It seemed strange to Mildred that the Matachine port sat undefended. Maybe it wasn't a stronghold after all. Christy shuffled up alongside Mildred, her red hair hanging lank around her shoulders. They decided not to talk in front of their captors, to not let on they were lucid, and to avoid possible injection of the drugs. The Whitecoats could have done that anyway, used hypodermics to dose them. But they seemed to want everything to be nice and friendly, all happy-faced smiles. Even when they were doing someone an injury, the pirates lowered three large rowboats over the side. The companions were forced into one of them, then joined by a trio of Matachine guards. Casacampo, the Whitecoats, and more pirates got into the other boats, leaving the black ship with a skeleton crew. At least the companions weren't doing the rowing this time. While they sat packed shoulder to shoulder on the stern thwarts, the pirates facing them amidships hauled back on the oars. The pirate lounging in the bow held a submachine gun balanced on his lap. The sun flashed on the golden trinkets wound around their boot tops. When Mildred glanced down, she saw a name etched on a dangling locket. Lupe, a delicate heart pendant on a thin gold chain. There were other names, too, and different styles of bracelet and necklace. Trophies of pillage, of rape and murder, worn like badges of honor, like combat medals. One of the rower Matachine caught her looking at his trinket collection. A lewd gleam in his eye, he puckered up and blew her an obscene kiss. Mildred fought to keep her face empty as she wondered what had kept the pirates in check on the journey south. After all, they had had access to the cabin she and Christy shared. Drugged women in chains. That sounded made to order for these creeps. Their lust, she reasoned, had to have been controlled by fear. If not fear of the wrath of their commander, then fear of the wrath of the lords of death. which, upon reflection, didn't bode all that well for any of the captives. It probably meant some greater purpose, or far nastier end, awaited them. The Mattachin beached the bows of the boats on the mudflats. Then Mildred and the others were hoisted out by the armpits by pirates on the other side. The seas were warm as bathwater, and this was as close to a bath as the Mattachin got. There was no way the captives could have navigated the oozing muck with their ankles and chains. The pirates sank in up to their knees as they struggled to lug them to the lip of a slimy concrete ramp that led up to the walkway. At Casacampo's signal, two of the Mattachin waded back out to the boats, pushed one off the mud, jumped in, and started rowing for the ship. A welcoming committee awaited the others on the platform above the ramp. If the five men were Mattachin, they had gone paramilitary. They wore jungle camouflage t-shirts and BDU pants. On shoulder slings, they carried the same stubby little 9mm submachine guns as the pirates. As the prisoners slowly ascended the ramp, little brown-faced kids peeked out at them through the glassless windows and doorless doorways of the shanties, then ducked back. Casacampo and Dr. Monteo approached one of the camouflage greeters, the one with the most radically sculpted face. He was wearing a broad-brimmed straw hat. To Mildred's surprise, the commander and the white coat didn't salute, or offer to shake hands, or simply nod. They immediately prostrated themselves on the walkway, raising their butts in the air, pressing their noses into the rough boards. Subservience in spades. The man they genuflected gestured with a finger, and the two rose. Casacampo cast a solemn gaze at his superiors.
Nibor, we have returned with gifts. My men and I went to Tierra de la Muerte and have laid waste to Padre Island. We have brought back these five most suitable subjects for your use. My crew and I will remain in Cologne to await the return of the prisoners. After that, we return to the sea to pillage in your name.
In a month, they will be ready for you.
Dr. Monteo was proud of his work, too. He pressed forward, pointing at the companions.
Look how healthy they are. My team and I produce great results. They are strong and will work well. I am certain of it.
Instead of a pat on the back, he got a disinterested glance from Nibor. The sun, filtered through the mesh of the straw, cast a tiny checkerboard of light and dark across Nibor's face. His head and eyebrows were shaved. The tops of his ears had been shaved as well, cut into points, and the lobes excised entirely. Narrow seams of scar tissue marked his brown cheeks, running from under the centers of his lower eyelids to his jawline, dividing his face into three unequal sections. Golden artificial fangs on his lower jaw curled out in front of his upper lip, the philtrum of which had been split like a dog's. The fleshy drapes pulled back so the sharpened points on his natural teeth could show. He wore a necklace of ivy-colored human finger bones, separated from each other by strung, gold-filled human teeth. Mildred knew extensive plastic surgery when she saw it. She had seen it on the Governor General of Veracruz as well. Whoever had wielded the number 15 scalpel was a highly skilled surgeon with the artistic vision of a raving psychopath. She wondered if Nibor was a priest or a warrior, or maybe a combination of both. The uniform he and the others in the welcoming committee sported was suitable for action, not empty mumbo-jumbo ceremony. The others all had shaved heads, but less extreme facial alterations. It occurred to her that the scarifications, like the height of the piled dreadlocks, might be symbols of rank, only permanent until death. Was the quintet a military wing of the Lords of Death priesthood? Or perhaps some specially tasked elite guard unit? Casacampo turned and gestured at his crew, then smiled slyly at Nibor.
My men and I are tired of banging the little brujas. I hope the local whorehouse will give us some better variety.
Brujas? Mildred blinked at the word. Witches? Was Casacampo talking about the little brown white coats? The two women in white smiled behind their upraised hands, happy as clams that they rated a mention to the big man. even if it was in the form of a complaint about their job performance.
Where is your last Inano?
There.
Casacampo pointed back at the water. Out of the mudflat, the rowboat had returned from the ship, bearing another passenger on the stern. This one swaddled, bagged head to foot in black mosquito netting. Though the passenger's ankles weren't manacled, the pirates carried him, or her, over the mud to the ramp. It wasn't until the shrouded one reached the top of the ramp that Mildred recognized who it was. The Fire Talker, Decipio. The mosquito netting was like a beekeeper suit with sewn-in arms and legs. The reason for the protection was a puzzle she couldn't immediately solve or bring herself to care about. The pirates kept him at a distance from the other captives and their bodies as a barrier between them as an extra precaution. Nibor waved for the Mattachine and their entourage to follow. Mildred and the companions were ushered along the walkways to dry land. Except for the curious children, the inhabitants of the little ville on stilts had apparently all taken cover, waiting for the potential Lords of Death storm to pass. The column walked along a deeply eroded dirt lane on the edge of Old Cologne. Most of the standing structures were rubbleized, home to small, darting lizards. Much larger striped iguanas slithered from sunning spots on concrete pads into the safety of the bush. The modern city above the treetops had been eaten alive by jungle. The empty window frames of the high-rises had been invaded by clusters of green creepers, like scavenger worms boring through the eye sockets of skulls. The farther they moved from the water, the hotter it got. The rilled road soon gave way to a narrower, tree-shaded lane. The shacks on either side of the path had to be of more recent construction. No way could those ramshackle affairs have withstood the force of the flood, although some were thrown up on the ruins of the pre-dark structures. Strangler vines wrapped around trunks and branches, their trumpet-like, bright yellow flowers gave off a dizzyingly sweet perfume. Some of the tree branches were laden with fruit as well. Papayas and guanabanas lay rotting on the ground. Black and white pigs, too drained by the heat to gorge themselves, lay panting on their sides in the shade at the sides of the road.
The land of plenty.
Mildred wondered what the population of Cologne was now. A few hundred souls, maybe? 1,000 at most? It was hard to say because there could have been dwellings off the lane in clearings deeper in the jungle. Ahead, peeking up over the treetops on the right, was a much bigger structure that had obviously ridden out, or more likely been missed, by the wall of floodwater. 2 stories high and easily 250 feet long, one side of its facade bordered the lane. It looked like an enormous Spanish hacienda from colonial times. White plaster perimeter, red tiled roof, black wood trim. As they got closer, where the concrete and plaster had fallen away, Mildred could see hugely thick brick walls underneath. At one time, shaded balconies along the second floor had overlooked the lane. They were long gone. All that remained were the jagged black remnants of their support posts. Steel shutters covered the second-story windows and balcony doors to keep out the heat, and presumably incoming bullets. There were holes in the roof where tiles had slipped away. The ground floor windows facing the lane were massively barred. Mildred noticed a pair of recent, rather crude additions to the corners of the roof. Machine gun posts, with their own palm frond sunshades. Across the lane from the hacienda, the jungle branches had been reduced to white-tipped stubs. Gut-hook machetes at work. Mildred guessed she was looking at the Mattachine headquarters. They were led through the story-and-a-half-tall double wooden gate. Mildred immediately smelled fresh horse shit. Sure enough, in the far corner of the yard was a stable. The enclosed compound was bordered on 4 sides by the wings of the hacienda. To their right, in front of a palm frond roofed patio, 4 horses were tied to a hitching post and 2 horse-drawn carts stood waiting. There were no gasoline or diesel-powered wags in sight. The Mattachine, Casacampo included, directed their attention to the shaded tables under the palm fronds and the dozen or so brown women who lounged on the chairs and couches there. The gaudy sluts grinned and waved for the men to join them, pointing at the full bottles of joy juice on the tabletops. A couple of them jerked down the necklines of their peasant blouses to expose black-tipped breasts. While Casacampo and his crew hurried over to introduce themselves, the paramilitaries hustled Mildred and the companions into the back of one of the horse carts. Their chains were looped through iron rings in the cart's low rear and side walls. When they were secured, Nibor and one of his lackeys helped Daniel into the cart as well. They put him forward, chaining his cuffs to the front wall, well out of the reach of his fellow passengers. Over on the patio, the sluts were getting comfortable on their pirates' laps, holding the bottles up so their new friends could drink their fill. One of the paramilitaries climbed onto the driver's seat of the companion's cart. Wherever they were headed, the 9mm subguns were not enough firepower. Nibor handed the cart driver a well-worn Soviet RPD, a 7.62mm 100-round drum-fed light machine gun. Mildred saw there was a mount for a bipod on the barrel right behind the front sight, but the bipod's legs were missing. It looked as if the weapon had been customized with a hacksaw. The driver set the machine gun on the seat beside him, close to hand. Nibor and the three others slung identical weapons across their backs, then mounted the saddled horses. Monteo and the little women climbed into a second, supply-loaded cart, and the doctor took the reins. With a lurch, the two-cart, six-horse convoy set off across the courtyard and through the open gates. The slow movement caused air to flow over Mildred's sweating body and face, but it did nothing to cool her off.
Ooh.
Mildred soon realized why they weren't riding in wags, why there were no wags in evidence inside the compound. Wags never could have made it over the shambles of a road, which deteriorated even further as they put the hacienda behind them. Broad, slick patches of exposed bedrock, potholes deep enough to bury a man. This was no better than Deathlands. As they jolted off the walls and bounced on the floor of the narrow wheel-based cart, Mildred turned her attention to the fire talker. Through the netting, she could see he still wore his ridiculous camouflage do-rag. She could also see how pale his skin had become. That was understandable. He hadn't seen the light of day for more than 3 weeks. From the dopey smile on his face, he was feeling no pain at present, thanks to the residual effect of his breakfast. The puzzle of the mosquito netting vexed her.
Daniel, why are they keeping you under wraps?
I had a bad reaction to bug bites.
That's why they locked you in the hold on the tug?
Uh-huh.
Christy frowned at him, her prehensile red hair rippling with her suspicion and disgust.
You looked pretty goddamn lively to me on Padre Island. Not sick at all when you set the pirates on us.
That's not the only thing that doesn't make sense. You didn't catch whatever it was that chilled the islanders.
Lucky, I guess.
Mosquito bites, virus, viral transfer. Daniel's isolation outside the target zone. Netting to protect those around him when he was out of doors. Suddenly, it all fell into place for Mildred. Fists tightly clenched at her sides.
Either you were lucky, or you brought the plague to Padre Island with you. You brought it there in your blood.
Doc blinked at Mildred, confusedly trying to follow her logic in his drugged state.
What are you saying?
I think our shit weasel here is a carrier. I think he's the source of that infection that slaughtered all those people on Padre. His blood is loaded with the disease virus. He's a walking biological weapon. Skeeters bite him, pick up the virus in his blood, then bite someone else and give it to them. On and on, until just about everyone in the surrounding area is infected. The disease would spread through an isolated population in a big hurry.
You bastard!
JB lunged for the fire talker, only to be brought up a yard short by his chains. Daniel jerked back, instinctively raising his netted hands to protect his face. Christy glared at him.
Is it true?
Daniel just shrugged.
What kind of a creature are you?
I believe, my dear Christy, the technical term for him is mass murderer.
It's in my blood. I can't help it. I didn't put it there. I didn't ask for it. They did it to me.
Who did it to you?
He told us he was part of a white coat experiment before Nuke Day. Said it went wrong.
You may not have asked for it, you sack of shit, but you can control how it's used.
Mildred is referring to your moral fiber, Mr. DeCipio, or lack thereof.
Oh, that isn't my fault either. It was my parents. They rejected me when I was little because I was different. They couldn't understand my need to read adventure books and try to write them. They were always yelling at me about it. I had to hide my short stories, or they'd burn them in the fireplace. They thought I was lazy and a daydreamer, maybe even somewhat mentally defective, and they were sure that I'd never amount to anything. I could never live up to their expectations, and that's haunted me ever since I was 7 years old. My parents have been dead more than a century, and I still think about their rejection every day.
Mildred's face twisted with disgust as she looked at the swaddled plague carrier.
You're a monster. A buck-passing, boo-hooing, self-made fucking monster.
It isn't like I killed those people with my own two hands.
Yeah, you don't have the stones for that.
I am not treated well, if that's what you're getting at. I am regarded as a necessary evil.
You're pure scum, so why should anyone treat you otherwise?
Because what I've got inside me has done a lot for them. It served their cause.
What do they intend to do to us?
Daniel shrugged again at Mildred, this time in apparent disinterest.
Where are they taking us?
They call it Shibalba. Someplace even warmer.
To hell, you mean?
Pretty much.
It was Jack's turn to make a grab for the fire talker, and he moved in a white blur of chain fury. Despite a valiant effort, the albino youth came up well short at the end of his chains. The companions rode on in stony silence. They had learned the hard way that they had to watch what they said in front of the net-draped backstabber. Mildred pondered Jack's attempt to get at the fire talker. The morning's drug seemed to be wearing off more quickly than usual, perhaps because they were all perspiring so heavily, sweating the dope right out of their systems. Ahead, Mildred saw that brown water covered a long section of the lane. Nibor and the other horsemen slowed down before they entered it. As the companion's cart rolled into the swampy section of roadway, the wheels began to shudder, and the cart box shook so violently it felt like it was going to fly apart. When Mildred looked over the side, the bow wave created by the front wheels revealed the cause of the rough ride. The road was made of foot-wide tree trunk sections, no doubt tropical hardwoods impervious to rot. They had been pounded straight down into the mud, edge to edge. This to keep the horse carts from sinking in over the tops of their wheels. They left the tree trunks and began climbing up a shallow grade. The sides of the road rose much faster than they did. Soon it was clear they were traveling in a man-made ditch. It was more than 50 feet deep. A shallow ooze of water meandered down the middle of it. In rainy season, the flow along this route would have been a torrent. In places, the side walls had caved in, top to bottom, from erosion, forcing the lane to wind back and forth around the mounds of toppled earth and rock. JB glanced around through water-splashed spectacles.
Where the fuck are we? Millie, you got any clue?
I think we're in what's left of the old ship channel. Believe it or not, this is the Atlantic entrance to the Panama Canal.
What canal? It's practically nuke and dry.
What do you think, Doc?
Remarkable. This project was underway when I was time-trolled. The French were a far cry from finishing it.
They never did finish it. They turned it over to the U.S. around 1900. It took another 15 years to get it done.
When completed, it was supposed to be one of the wonders of the modern world.
Jack's red eyes swept the muddy destruction.
Not so wonderful. Looked like a nuke and big shithole.
But where are the locks? There have to be locks.
My guess is they broke open, probably from earthquakes on nuke day. One after another, like dominoes falling. Then the force of the water released from the dammed up lakes tore the gates right out of the bedrock. Tore out all the shoring, too. 30 years of sweat and sacrifice, gone in the blink of an eye.
After what Mildred estimated was a 3-mile journey, they exited the far end of the narrow channel. In front of them, the vista broadened, exposing a plain of destruction all the way to the western horizon. It was the former artificial lake bed. This was a different sort of devastation, a vast table of low scrub vegetation and bare rock, broken here and there by densely forested humps and hills. The high points and elevation that had been turned into islands when the river valley was flooded to form the lake. When the trillions of gallons of water had flowed out to sea, it had scraped the landscape clean, right down to the bedrock. The road in front of them was much wider and well-traveled. It ran string straight for a good mile. Then it disappeared around a forested mound. They descended onto the sweltering plain. skeletons of 100-foot-tall trees, 2 centuries dead, drowned when the land was inundated, were smothered in drooping tangles of strangler vines. The second growth scrub was no more than 8 feet high and packed into dense patches, presumably where some topsoil remained. Clouds of black flies buzzed over potholes, filled with stagnant water. Wide swatches of wet mud, possibly quicksand, lay just off the rutted path. The convoy made slow but steady progress, heading toward the flanks of the low island hills. When Mildred looked behind them, off to the right, she saw a vast wedge of smooth concrete embedded in the lake's rim. The dam hadn't burst after all. That explained the extent of the damage to Cologne. The full force of the flood had gone out the ship channel, through the city, into the bay, not the natural river channel well to the west. Under the blazing sun, in the still air, the blistering heat and humidity, it was hard to breathe. Mildred looked at Daniel.
It must be close to 50 miles to the Pacific side of this ditch. Are we going that far? Is it all going to be like this?
The poser closed his eyes, pretending that he was asleep. Over and over, Mildred tried to figure it out. What did these fuckers want with them? Why them in particular? Why were they pulled out of the line in the fort while the other survivors of Padre in the 3 weeks of rowing dragged off to ritual slaughter? It was Casacampo who'd done it. It had been his decision to spare their lives for something. The bits of the puzzle were there. She could feel it, but she couldn't quite piece them together. Not yet, anyway. If they were going to get out of this mess, Mildred knew they were all going to have to stop eating. She also knew it was possible that JB, Doc, and Jack would experience withdrawal symptoms. Fever, itching, sweating, nervousness. Symptoms that would be difficult to hide. On the trail, there would be no way to rinse off the drugs. They would have to ditch their food somehow. And do it in front of Daniel without his catching on. That wasn't going to be easy. Looking at the sniveling bastard feigning sleep to avoid confrontation, she'd wish she'd had another yard of slack in her chain. Kicking in his head, even if it didn't save their lives, would ultimately save the lives of innumerable others. As they approached the first of the island's hills, coming within perhaps 200 yards of it, the caravan halted. Nibor and the other horsemen dismounted. Their cart driver locked the brake, then picked up the RPD. For a split second, when he stood and turned the weapon toward them, Mildred's heart sank. They were all going to die. That's what the others thought, too. She could see it in their eyes. Then her white coat's logical brain kicked in. Driving all the way out here just to execute them seemed like a whole lot of trouble for nothing. The cart driver held the light machine gun braced against his hip, aimed not at the passengers, but at the scraggly line of scrub trees off to their left. Nibor and the other horsemen aimed their weapons toward the forested hill and points on either side. In the distance, Mildred could see leaves and branches clipped off and dropped by the spray of bullets and puffs of dust where they struck and skipped off the bare ground. This in a broad half circle in front of them. If there were hostiles out there lurking, if there were savage critters out there lying in wait, they either turned tail or fell flat on their bellies. Nibor and his men reloaded their RPDs with fresh drum magazines before the convoy moved on. Commander Guillermo Casacampo lay in a stinking, moaning heap. The light of the Coleman lamp on the floor beside the mattress played over the erratic slurp and slap of sweaty flesh as three of the hacienda sluts rendered intimate service. The woman astride him had a determined, screwed-up, go-for-broke expression on her face as she merrily humped away. The other faces were busy, hidden behind the curves of her flipping hips, busy making lollipops of his testicles. Casacampo was in hog heaven, lying back, smoking a fat black cigar while getting seriously laid. Similar exertions earlier in the evening had caused his high-piled hair to fall loose and tumble down around his shoulders. The women wore borrowed golden trinkets from his coif's treasure trove on their brown wrists and around their slender necks. These sluts really knew how to screw, and their enthusiasm for the work was appreciated. He clenched the cigar between his teeth. The pirate's hips jerked up from the mattress in a flurry of rapid, savage thrusts. When his release faded, Casacampos sank back onto the sweaty sheets, taking the cigar out of his mouth. The slut disengaged herself and rolled onto her back beside him. Casacampos smiled at the chorus of rhythmic moans coming from rooms down the hall. His crew was hammering it, doing credit to the Matachin name. Then his head began to spin. It spun so fast, he had to close his eyes and hang on to the edge of the bed. How much had he drunk? How much weed had he smoked? How many times had these sweaty little bitches brought him to climax? For the life of him, he couldn't remember. One of the other sluts picked up a jar from the floor, dipped a finger into its contents, then started smearing the semi-liquid stuff on his rapidly diminishing erection. The jungle concoction was cool at first, then warm, then warmer still. He felt a tickle deep in his pelvis as his manhood slowly but surely became hard yet again. No doubt about it, these cologne ladies were multi-talented mistresses of the fuck. Not so much to look at from the neck up, as most of their teeth had cracked edges like they'd been used to open beer bottles. But they didn't giggle like idiots the whole time they were being banged, like some he could name. The anointing slut hurriedly straddled his hips. As she leaned back, impaling herself on him, he gave her a resounding smack on the behind. Then the room's door opened and slammed back. Everyone on the mattress looked as a naked pirate staggered in, his eyes bugging out of his head. At first, Casacampo thought the soldier was just wild-ass drunk. Then he saw that his throat had been cut from ear to ear. Blood sheeted over his bare chest and dripped down his legs onto the floor. The wounded Matachin fell to his knees. A savage boot between the shoulder blades drove the dying man face first into the floor. Casacampo blinked in shock and the cigar dropped from his gaping mouth. In the glow of the lantern, he saw the straps of a headlamp, then the black eye patch. He saw the silencer-equipped submachine gun and the machete stained crimson from gut hook to handguard. Then the second man stepped alongside the first. Another eye patch, only the opposite eye socket was covered. Both of them were alive. Both of them had escaped execution. Chucho smirked, pointing the fat shroud of a submachine gun silencer at Casacampo's dick.
You're not going to be needing that.
Fuck you!
Casacampo groped alongside the mattress for his other weapon. Not a chance. The blue-eyed hero twin put a boot sole on the barrel of the 9mm subgun, pinning it to the floor as he raised the machete to strike. The sluts ducked their heads and scattered for the far corners of the room as Chucho snapped a sharp kick right on Casacampo's ass.
Yeah. Get up, asshole! You're coming with us.
Should we put some pants on him?
Fuck the bastard, Ryan. Let him go naked.
Chucho waved the women to their feet, then ushered them out of the room like a mother hen.
Come, my brown beauties. These stinking murderers will never molest you again.
Barefoot, bare-assed, his tower of dreads, the symbol of his rank, deconstructed, the commander was unceremoniously booted through the doorway and into the second-story hall.
Someone is going to come to kill you, you one-eyed bastards. Two creepers like you can't kill my whole crew.
Chucho shoved him onward toward the main staircase. He stumbled past the open doors of rooms lit by white gas lanterns. The other sluts had all fled. In every room, his men lay naked, butchered like hogs on the mattresses or the floor, sprawled in spreading pools of their own blood. No one had gotten off a shot. No one had gotten off a shout. The hero twins had made their way down the hall, room by room, to take him last of all. Drunk on joy juice, high on marijuana, in the midst of a marathon screw session, his pirates were not expecting that kind of trouble. Still, how could two men overcome 10 times of their number and not raise an alarm? It turned out there was a third member of the team. Another gringo waited for them at the top of the stairs. He had long, flowing mustaches and a big stainless steel revolver on his hip. Like the others, he carried a silenced submachine gun and wore a headlamp, this over the crown of his bill cap. Casacampo offered up no empty threats as he was urged down the staircase by the hero twins' boots. To his right, the courtyard tile floor was wet with blood. More pirates lay dead with their throats cut, their dreads soaking up the spilled gore like sponges. He could see the yawning second mouths under their chins. Their necks had been sliced all the way to their spinal columns. In his mind, Casacampo tried to keep track of the crew he'd lost so far, and those still left to put up a fight. By his count, there were still at least 8 at large. More than enough to chop down these running dogs. Chucho and the Blue Eye hustled him out the double doors onto the covered patio in the courtyard. By the light of the guttering candelabrum, he saw more dead men, these killed by wire garrots, their eyeballs blood red, their faces black and bloated. Their tongues protruded as if they were giving final, obscene black raspberries to the world. Out in the courtyard, there was yet another corpse, this one face down, the back of its skull split open. The intruders turned on their headlamps and the beams cut through the humid darkness. Obviously, they were confident that they had killed everyone inside the hacienda. The machine gunners on the rooftop were dead too, Casacampo reasoned, or they would have opened fire by now. The commander realized that Chucho and his two friends had to have wrecked the grounds before the assault. They knew how many Matachin there were and where to find them. 16 dead. He was down to 3 on his side. Even odds. When he was marched through the wide-open stable doors, his hope evaporated. In the light of a lantern sitting on a hay bale, he saw 3 bodies hanging by their necks from the rafters. They dangled dead still. Spines snapped, necks stretched to the splitting point. If the twins and the gringo had fired a single shot to bring any of them down, there was no evidence of it. The commander, despite his resolve to stay strong to the end, was taken aback. They had killed 19 trained, battle-seasoned pirates, and none of the victims had made a sound or apparently put up a fight. It was hard to shout a warning when your throat was cut so deep that your vocal cords were severed, or when a wire noose was squeezing off your air and the blood flow to your brain. Casacampo had always considered Chucho's reputation to be overblown, fabricated out of whole cloth to make the priests and red sashes seem less incompetent. For one man to do so much damage to them and get away with it again and again, he had to be bigger than life, right? The commander was having second thoughts about that assessment now. What if all of it was true? True, and then some. They made him stand in front of his hanged men. Then the gringo with the mustache eyed him.
5 gringos, 2 women, and 3 men. Where are they?
Fuck you, gringo.
Looking down at the splotch of nasty on his toe, the gringo shook his head in disapproval.
We're gonna give you to Chucho, then.
The renowned bandit and murderer had picked up a hand scythe from a hook on the stable wall. He slashed the crescent of pitted steel back and forth, testing its balance and reach. Casacampo's heart thudded up under his chin. He had faced death many times before, but never naked, never with his hands tied behind his back. To make things much worse, Chucho was staring fixedly at his flaccid manhood as he whipped the scythe back and forth.